Order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Thursday, April 7th, 2005. We are in a hearing on House Bill 5016, Department of Corrections, and we are doing the Phase 2 overview. I'm going to begin with Doug Wilson, and then I'd like to just invite Director Williams and Linda Gilbert to come on up, and we can make the transition from Mr. Wilson's comments to the department's comments as we move forward. Come on up. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, there's a memo from me to the subcommittee members that I'll quickly go through. I don't want to spend very much time on this. These are all, this is relative, or issues you've seen already. The agency mission, primary programs and customers, I don't want to go through. They're there for your convenience, and the director has already gone through this in his overview, and it'll probably be reiterated and reinforced during the Phase 2 items and presentations over the next few days. At the top of page 2 of the memo, there are, I do want to make sure that you know what budget notes, e-board actions, and audit findings there were. Budget notes, there were a number of budget notes in the 2003-05 budget report that accompanies the budget. They were instructed to report to the e-board a number of times on substance abuse and cognitive programs in terms of the plan and progress for evaluating the effectiveness of this. The budget note did include language requesting the governor include additional resources if necessary for related data collection and evaluation. My understanding is that this will be discussed a little later in the presentation when we get to another portion of the budget. They talked about overtime that had been audit findings in the past, and they reported the e-board on overtime during the biennium. They did go through a large, long, extended exercise on the third bullet on development of staffing standards for non-security staff. They had done a similar exercise 2 years before this on the security staff. And as far as I can tell, that has been used in terms of putting together their budget for the 05-07 biennium. You have already heard from the Board of Parole on the fourth bullet in post-prison supervision about this budget note, and the Parole Board as well as the Department were, did jointly report to the E-Board on the effectiveness of the revocations and sanctions between individual counties' performance on recidivism rates. And finally, as part of this budget presentation, sometime during Phase 2, the agency was instructed to report on the use of fees by the local community corrections program. If I remember right, that was of interest to Senator Winters from 2 years ago. And my expectation, I think, is that they will talk about this when they get to that portion of the budget, which will be sometime next week. The department did visit, if visit is a good word to use, to the emergency board on a number of occasions, even beyond the e-board items or the reports that I mentioned above. And they did come back on a couple times in community corrections as the legislature restored the reductions made by ballot measure 30. They did come back at least once or twice on prison population capacity planning, and like other major agencies, they do come back from time to time to rebalance across appropriation lines, something that will have to be done yet this biennium when we get to work session. They do have a need to move around a little bit in their budget. Audit findings is there in the middle of page 2. A number, you know, they have a number of audits just like any other major agency. I do want to just make sure that you are aware of one of the major issues raised by the audit division was part of an audit of the automatic financial accounting manufacturing inventory system, also known as AFAMIS. This is the department's major financial computer application. A number of issues came out of that, and at the same time, many of these were accounting related, both in terms of the development of the system and some of the other accounting issues that or activities are related to the system, and the budget does contemplate, in the governor's recommended budget, adding some accounting positions to address some of these issues, so you'll need to keep that in mind.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I could, have we been briefed on, you know, what was identified in these audits as far as improvements and payments? I mean, those are pretty basic financial responsibilities of payments, controls, you know, the payroll. Those are, have we been briefed on the audit?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I don't think the committee has been briefed. I think they have taken corrective action to take care of most of those things at the first part of the paragraph.
Not all of them?
I would have to go back and check, or the agency can respond when they get to that part of their budget in Phase 2 presentation.
I would appreciate that, Madam Chair.
You would like more detailed information, Representative Wisnott?
Yes, ma'am.
Each of the audits referenced in the...
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
So that takes care of the audit, and I would... when they get to that portion of the budget, which is the general services portion, it probably would be good for them to address that. Many of those issues are found in many departments on an ongoing basis where the audit division suggests improvements. I think the largest issue was around, at least in terms of the audit division's thinking, was around the automated financial accounting manufacturing inventory system audit. Revenue history, I'll just give you a brief table there at the bottom of page 2 that outlines sort of how things have changed in terms of their fund sources. It is primarily a general fund agency. I do want to make sure that you see sort of the differences over a few years or over these biennium. You'll notice in at least the first three biennia on that chart, the other funds was a significant portion, more so than in later years. And part of that is used because of refinancing of COPs or certificates of participation, and then using some of those proceeds to offset the need for general fund. That explains part of it. In the 2003-2005 biennium, the second from the right bar there, the federal funds is a large amount, and then disappears in the 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget. That is the $116 million that was a one-time infusion into their budget of federal funds to offset general fund. That money is not available for the 2005-2007 biennium. On the third page is some expenditure history. Again, things generally across their major programs increase, you know, generally at the same rate, except for capital construction, and that just reflects sort of the biennium to biennium nature of capital construction and how projects are approved by the legislature. You'll notice in 2003-2005 there was little or nothing in capital construction, while the 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget has a significant share. I think it's $145 million for proposed for Madras, as well as expansions at Coffee Creek and other projects. In terms of the major budget and policy issues, at the bottom of page 3, probably the largest is keeping pace with the population growth. You'll notice on page 4 of the memo, you've seen this chart before, it's been updated, but most of that increase is due to the increasing impact of ballot measure 11 throughout the biennium. While the sort of the base or the all other population has remained, you know, grows at a slight rate, ballot measure 11, as well as those population that have repeat property offenders in it, has also increased and continues to increase at a significant rate. There are continuing discussions, for a lack of better term, around Madras and the construction of Madras. Options that are being looked at is the use of the Wapato facility in Multnomah County, which is 525 beds, but you'll need to, the population will continue to come, and unless there are sentencing changes. So the options are either leasing existing facilities, renting beds, both in-state and out-of-state, or construction. And you have to identify or plan in the future for one of those three ways or a combination to keep pace with the population growth without changes in sentences. A recently released forecast in the past couple weeks shows that the prison population is not growing quite as fast as had been anticipated in the governor's budget, but really what that does is just push back the need for prison beds by a few months. And during work session, we'll talk a little more detail about that that population forecast. It does save, I think it's $10.5 million of general fund from what's in the governor's budget purely based on that prison population forecast. And that is assumed in the two budgets that have been released early this week as savings.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, ma'am. So you're saying the 10.5 is already in the...
It is in that packet. There's also the same forecast shows some community corrections, changes to the budget. It is much more complex, and I think I will wait until either the agency or till work session or later in phase two to go through that, because it's a combination of population distribution across various groups within the community corrections population and the implementation or proposed implementation of the band model, which I think the department will describe in a more detail, and it gets very confusing, so I think it's best to set the basis in the agency presentation for that. But the resources in the revised governor's budget, I'm not sure if that's the right term, but the budget adjusted for the new forecast is still less than what is needed to prevent counties from opting out. The House budget restores enough, definitely enough to get back to the opt-out threshold. The Senate budget doesn't quite reach it. So that is one consideration that you'll need to take into account. And finally, the governor's budget makes some reductions. I think it's $2.5 million to various programs, significantly mentioning the alcohol and drug abuse programs and the cognitive programs. The governor's budget does make that reduction. It is included in both of the House and Senate co-chair plans. Those reductions continue in those plans, and keep in mind that these programs in large part are designed to reduce recidivism in the future. But the impact, it's hard to measure what the, an exact number, an estimated number of that impact in future biennial. And Madam Chair, that just outlines the comments that I wanted to make before we go into phase two.
Senator Devlin or Representative Wisnot, any questions or comments? Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. Working again from this presentation. On page 2, we have the context slide. Today, we are going to look at a budget that is over 50% of the total public safety program area when it comes to all funds. The total is $1.25 billion with a B. With respect to general fund and lottery fund, the Department of Corrections budget is at $1.1 billion is over 68% of the public safety program area budget. The next four pages are the four views of this agency's budget. On page 3, we start with the budget by fund type. Clearly, at $1.25 billion, the lion's share, over 85%, is in general fund. That's $1.1 billion. Other funds, 14% of the budget, $177.6 million. And finally, federal funds is $4.3 million, 3/10 of 1% of the budget. Talking about revenue, the sources of revenue in other funds, it's the Inmate Welfare Fund, which is canteen profits, fines, confiscations, vending machine money, things like that. Proceeds from borrowing and funds from other state agencies, specifically the Department of Education and community colleges for education programs. The federal funds in this budget come from the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program, sometimes called SCAP. $4.3 million is expected.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner. Mrs.
Gilbert, could you expand on what does that mean? What's that program from the feds?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, this provides funding for non-citizens that the department holds as inmates. It provides some funding, not total, not as much as would be needed, but it is some.
Follow up.
Please.
So is it based upon our population, or we just get a flat grant to, so we have to document the population to get that amount, or what is it based upon?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think it could be, I'll have the agency explain, but I think it's two things. One is just how big is the pot to begin with, whatever is Congress is appropriating, and then beyond that, it's doled out to states, but who knows on what basis.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, my recollection is the formula is somehow not necessarily based to your overall alien population, but state size, total population, and a number of factors. We get a considerably lesser amount than larger states would get, obviously, with bigger systems. We can get you the details on how the formula works. The money is been traditionally not included in the President's budget on a regular basis and was not included in the President's budget submitted to Congress for this congressional session. Traditionally, Congress has on its own accord acted to restore that funding. So BAM and LFO have assumed that $4.4 million because traditionally it's been forthcoming, but it certainly has a bit of a question mark on whether or not we would actually receive it.
Yes, one other follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
So I guess the next question to that is, are we getting... Do we have more inmates that fit that requirement? And so do we want to go back and try to ask our congressional delegation that we got an unusual amount, or are we okay with that? We don't want to speak up, or have you looked at that situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we do not. That $4.4 million does not fully cover the cost of our housing of alien inmates, non-U.S. citizen inmates within our system. And it isn't intended, I don't believe Congress has ever intended to fully fund the state's burden. This is more of a program designed to offset some of those costs, but not to fully insure or fund the states for their housing of non-resident aliens in the correctional system. So I would tell you that we get our fair share of that money as it's divided among the states under the formula, but certainly it doesn't meet the entire obligation that the state assumes for housing those offenders.
Could we get the information on what the resulting gap is in funding?
Yeah, we'd be pleased to provide that, Madam Chair.
In addition to how the formula works.
And I think instead of burning up the time of the committee and sort of talking about it and going through the formula detail, we could just easily put this on our list of some of the things we'll respond to the committee in writing to do.
That would be great.
Madam Chair, as a side note, this has always been a bone of contention for the states not getting even close to the share. And in fact, one governor made the suggestion that he or she may just drop off a few busloads of folks in front of a federal prison that out of their system. So it is an ongoing discussion between states and the federal government. Mm-hmm. And Congress has traditionally restored a share of the funding that has been left out of the president's budget. I think Mr. Williams mentioned that.
Thank you. And please continue.
Moving to page 4, we look at the budget from the point of view of the 8 program units that are in this budget. If this pie chart were a clock, I would be starting at 3 o'clock with the operations division. This is the largest program. It's at $668.975 million. It's 54% of the total budget. And this, the operations division, is responsible for overall institution and inmate management. Second, central administration is at $45 million, or 3.6% of the budget. And this division has the director's office, the deputies, public affairs office, research, planning and budget, project management, internal audits, and the inspector general. In addition, this budget includes all the agencies, state government service charges, attorney general charges, and issuance and maintenance costs associated with certificates of participation. Moving left to the General Services Division, this division at $43.5 million is 3.5% of the budget. And in General Services, it's Fiscal Services, Information System Services, Facility Services, and finally Distribution. moving up to transitional services at 17.5% of the budget. This division is responsible for programs and for the community corrections grants funding. The Human Resources Division is $10.6 million, or 0.8% of the budget. This division handles personnel, payroll, recruiting, labor relations, and all the duties associated with the human resources. Moving up to debt service, in the governor's recommended budget, it is $118.8 million, or about 9.5% of the budget, and that is general fund. It includes $102.8 million for existing construction that has already occurred or existing borrowing, and $16 million in new. Capital improvements at $2.3 million is 0.2% of the budget. And finally, capital construction at $145.6 million is over 11% of the budget. This includes $131 million for Madras prison construction and $14.2 million for Coffee Creek expansion. The next view of the budget is by budget category on page 5. And I would say the main message of this page is that clearly running 24-hour institutions requires a lot of labor, and thus personal services at $586.4 million is 47% of the budget by budget category. Services and supplies is about 17%, $218 million. Capital outlay is $161 million. That includes the capital construction dollars that we talked about on the previous page.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnott.
Thank you. To you, Madam Chair, to Doug, what do we look at in capital purchases? Do we get involved in anything over $10 million, $5 million? Is there a threshold there? This number, in other words, I'm assuming the 145 and the 2 is 147, so we're talking about $14 million more of capital. Is that for computers? Is they, you know, and do we review or approve anything over a certain amount, or is that done at the department?
Would you like to comment on that?
I'm trying to make sure. So you're looking at the capital outlay, the
13%. $161 million.
Most of that will be the $145 million of, and actually, I'm trying to think what the other portion would be. They would have
capital
improvements,
which
is the 1.2 or the 2.3. I'll have to check what else is in there. Sue, do you know? Or is it?
Capital outlay.
So is
vehicles, it would include vehicles.
Capital, okay. Computer, anything. But yeah. Is there a threshold that we look at or the legislature approves or his department?
As part of the work session or part of the presentation, it would be good for you to have an idea of the list of those that are identifiable. Keep in mind on things like capital improvements, they'll have a list of projects, but that list may change based on the immediate need if a roof fails or an electrical system fails. So generally the things that you approve are more like the capital construction amounts specifically you approve.
Thank you.
Does that take care of your question,
yes,
Mr.
Ma'am.
Senator? Okay. Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Actually, question for Ms. Gilbert in a sense. Because of the way that budget and management typically presents these, showing the entire budget and capital, and in this case, some services that are actually payments to outside agencies. It tends to understate what the costs of the agencies are in terms of percentage that's personnel. Like most state agencies, this probably, the core functions, the operational functions, would probably be in the 80 or 85% category for personnel costs. Wouldn't that be close to, once you back out those items and you look at,
Madam Chair,
pretty relatively close to it.
Senator Devlin, are you talking about on the previous page when we looked at operations division, how much of that would be personal services?
Right. I mean, we tend to understate those amounts because we put capital in it. If we're looking at the actual operating costs of the agency itself, a much higher percentage is personnel than shown here, because you have both capital here, you have debt service here, and you actually have payments that are going to outside agencies here. So I just wanted to...
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, other monies that could be considered personal services money that we wouldn't specifically track would be in special payments because those are the dollars that go to the counties
right.
to hire the folks that do the community corrections.
Just trying to make your point that you're very personnel
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if it would be 85%. You'd have to do the math.
Yeah.
There are some significant service and supply costs, pharmaceuticals.
Right.
Some of the medical, much of the medical is personal service.
Utilities.
Utilities, food, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it would be as high as 85%, but if you backed out the payments to counties and the debt service and capital construction, you'd be approaching that.
Before you continue, Ms. Gilbert, I would like to welcome some of my constituents from Grant High School and also Sunnyside Environmental School. Welcome to your capital. Hope you have a great experience today. Good to see you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Still on page 5, the last element is debt service, and that we have already discussed on a previous page. The following page shows a short history, starting with 9901 actuals, of this agency's budget. Essentially, two messages on this page. The first is, if you look at general fund over time, you see that from 9901 through 0305, it's climbing at a regular, at a fairly steady and regular pace. In 0507, it seems to explode, going up to $1 billion. And there are several reasons for that 34% increase. The largest of the reasons is the one that Mr. Wilson already discussed, which is $116 million of federal funding that was a one-time infusion when Congress took pity on the state. In addition, part of this, about $77 million, would be due to just the increase in population managing that. There's $16 million additional for additional debt service in there. And the rest of it would be ordinary inflation as well as extraordinary inflation for things like medical services, that kind of thing. So that's why that number has jumped so much in 0507 from 0305. The second kind of an anomaly here, Doug had already discussed this to some degree, and this is in other funds. It's at a much higher level in the first two biennia, falls quite low in 0305, and that was the absence of capital construction funding. In 0507, there is capital construction funding again, and that is other funds because it is the proceeds from certificates of participation. Moving on to page 7. Under policy issues or assumptions, this budget includes or assumes that there is no change in sentencing law, which has the impact on the population having to be accepted. There's a continued prison construction, as we'd already discussed, to accommodate the population. It also assumes compliance with federal and constitutional mandates with respect to programs and care provided and accommodations provided for the inmates. On page 8, there are the cost drivers. What probably should be the first item here for forecasted prison population growth is arrest data, conviction rates that then drive what happens with the forecast as well as sentencing laws. This particular budget is based on the October 2004 forecast, as Mr. Wilson discussed. There is now a newer forecast. The growth is lower and somewhat less, and that will get more of a discussion in work session. Other cost drivers are community corrections population growth, personal services cost increases, debt service on existing construction, and construction of new facilities with its accompanying debt service.
Ms. Gilbert and Director Williams, medical costs are not listed as a separate cost driver. Are we to assume that that's included in forecasted prison population growth, or how does that...
Madam Chair, yes, in a couple of ways. The agency can go through a process to request extraordinary inflation on certain costs that they expect to be to have a higher than standard 5% medical inflation. In addition, when a new forecast comes, the agency calculates the cost of the new forecast, including the medical expense associated with that.
it would be helpful to give your heads up, Director Williams, to unpack those medical costs as much as possible in your testimony, so that we understand better understand how that is included in that 34.2% increase in your overall budget.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we will both Mr. Zerniak, whose operations division has responsibility for the medical unit, and then in our more detailed discussion, probably in work session about the actual budget figures, we'll be glad to provide you detailed information on our costs associated with medical expense.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Question about the institutional physical plan. That would be the line item under which you would be paying utilities, I would assume. Is that correct? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, utilities would be included in the operations division.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out where it would show up in terms of costs.
I think it shows up in other divisions as well, but certainly the bulk of it is in operations.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think he's looking at the priority list, the final
right.
Prior. I believe it would probably be spread in the lines that are the housing lines toward the top. I believe the fuels and utilities and those kinds of costs of operations are included in, I think it's termed housing.
Okay.
There's like three lines for various housing.
Okay. Yeah, I see those. Okay, thank you.
On the final page, page 9, technical adjustments, there will be several. They are rather small and indeed technical in nature, and the details of them will be something that will be brought forward in the work session. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. And turning now to Director Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's our pleasure to be back in front of you for our Phase 2 presentation on the budget this afternoon. And to begin that presentation, it's been quite some time since our Phase 1 presentation, and I see that most of you have your notebooks, and we can hopefully move right along. I did want to just give you a bit of an order of the presentation that we'll make over the next few days that we'll spend together. We'll start with a presentation from Assistant Director Zerniak, who is the Assistant Director of our Operations Division. We'll move then from Operations to Transitional Services, from Transitional Services to General Services, from General Services to our Human Services, and then we'll end on the administration portion of our budget. Our hope is to keep this as informative for you as possible while laying a foundation for our budget request. Certainly we'll pursue any lines of information or questioning that the committee feels is appropriate. At the same time, our goal is to try to give you sort of a certain base of knowledge about the details of each of these separate divisions within the Department of Corrections so you can understand the nature of our budget request and the governor's recommended budget. We will be operating off the governor's recommended budget numbers. As you've heard mentioned a couple of times already this afternoon, we did get an April forecast on prison population that in fact did change some of those projections. We're going to hold on giving you sort of the detailed impact of those changes until we move sort of more into the numbers portion of the presentation, likely later in the week. We could do it that way, or if you desire, after each of the divisional components, we can bring Ms. Aka forward and we can talk about it at that time as well, whichever the committee best prefers. At the end of each of the divisional components.
To keep things in context,
sure.
That would be helpful.
And we'd be happy to do that. As the co-chairs have each released their idea about the budget and the impact, we thought we would wait towards the end of the presentation as well to talk to you more specifically about those particular impacts. And we think it would be a more useful conversation at that point after we've had a chance to sort of lay the foundation that made up the basis of our budget request and the governor's recommended budget. So if that's with the chair's approval, then I will introduce to you Stan Zerniak, who is our Assistant Director of Operations. Mr. Zerniak has previously been the superintendent at the Oregon State Penitentiary. For those of you who were able to attend the tour last Friday, Mr. Zerniak was involved in providing you a tour of the institution, and we appreciate you, committee members, and those of your staff who accompanied us on that tour and took the time. I think in many ways a walk through the institution for a couple of hours is probably worth four or five times that amount of time in testimony in a hearing room. But we're here over the next 4 days to serve the committee in any way we can to provide you the information you're looking for and to respond to any of your questions. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Zerniak.
Chair Gardley and members of the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee, good afternoon. My name is Stan Zerniak, and I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections. We in the Operations Division sincerely appreciate having the opportunity to review with you how we are organized to meet our multiple missions. Our primary mission directly mirrors the number one principle of your committee, and that is to provide for public safety and to, in fact, protect the public. And we do this by establishing procedures and strategies to prevent escapes, to manage institutions that are safe for our staff, for our contractors, for our volunteers, and for our inmates. We take these responsibilities very seriously. We are also, one of our top priorities is to provide stable prison environments so that that will be conducive to the successful operation of programs and services for inmates that are geared toward the transition strategy that has as its goal to mitigate the risk that inmates in our system will return back to the Department of Corrections once they're released to the community. We in the Operations Division also appreciate the awesome responsibility that you have and our responsibility to therefore provide to you with accurate and complete information about our operation and why we do the things the way we do them. The number one challenge that's facing the Operations Division from this point on is the anticipated gain of somewhere around 1,500 inmates from this date until the end of the next biennium. To address and to meet that challenge, we have organized the Operations Division into six distinct but interrelated units. These units include the Institutions Unit, Health Services, Capacity and Resource, Security, Inmate Work Programs, and the Operations Policy Management. The Operations Division is organized to support the following principles. Correctional institutions will be secure, safe, civil, and productive for the public, staff, and inmates. In addition, we will provide support for the Oregon Accountability Model and for the Department of Corrections mission. In addition, we will be cost-effective using available inmate labor, automation, new technologies, and the efficient utilization of resources and other strategies to achieve economies and efficiencies. This ends page one. I request that you turn to page three. Page two is just really a lead-in to our organizational charts. On page three and page four, you will see the organizational charts for the current biennium that we're in right now and also for the coming biennium. What you will notice between those two organizational charts is that in the coming biennium, we're reflecting a gain of 470 additional positions. These positions are largely tied to expansions at the Shutter Creek Correctional Institution, which include 42 staff, expansion at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which includes 63 staff, the opening of the Madras facility on September 1st, which will be 128 staff, and the request for 225 positions for the Madras minimum security 864-bed unit, which is projected for an opening on October of 2006. This ends the organizational charts. If you could turn to page 5.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
I'm sorry. Could you give me the numbers for the Madras again, please? The FTEs and the beds, please.
Chair Gorley and Representative Wisnant, yes, that would be 225 staff, And the total number of inmates for that unit would be 864 minimum custody inmates.
Thank you. And none for Lakeview, Madam Chair?
Chair Gorley and Representative Wisnett, yes. Lakeview would have a, that's the Warren Creek Correctional Facility.
Okay.
That would have an additional 128 staff when it opens up on September 1st. And that is for a 400-bed minimum custody institution.
Senator Devlin.
You may have actually a more updated version than we have, actually, because we have the version from that we got when we got the original packet. And maybe you're adding things together, but we showed 190 positions, because they're starting late, 92 FTE for Madras. That's probably the minimum.
I didn't see the next page. That's where it is. I'm looking at the wrong page. Funny timing.
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin, yes, I think what we're reflecting there is that we also have, what we're reflecting there on the Madras chart are strictly security-based positions. There were also counseling staff, and there would be medical staff as well as physical plant staff.
Another question, actually.
So just to clarify, looking again at Lakeview or Warner Creek, the information we have in our notebooks is the 106 positions and the 102.36 FTE, but the number you're providing to us is different. It's 128.
Chair Gorley, that's correct. No, that would include staff of all job classifications within the prison. The 106 really just reflects security-based positions.
So, Madam Chair, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Stan, part of the 359 positions under health services, there'd be a few positions there for Lakeview or Warner Creek. Counseling, there'd be a few positions out of that 70. So it depends on, that's where the other portion.
But that's the relationship.
Chair Gorley and Mr. Wilson, that is correct. And we'd be happy to provide you a complete breakdown of all those positions, and for this and for the other expansions as well.
That would be helpful, just so that we can keep, so we're all reading from the same page, if you will. Senator Devlin?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking just at the institutional positions now, and I'm noting that in a number of them that you dropped down by a few personnel in each one of the institutions from 03, 05 to 05, 07. I can identify almost all of these by your acronym, and I know it's got to be some small facility somewhere. SCCINWWC.
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin, right. What we're talking about there is the Shutter Creek Correctional Institution and the North Bend Work Camp.
Okay. And you do have some expansion there.
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin, that's correct. The expansion there will be a total of 100 minimum custody beds that are slated to open up in December of 2005, and this includes a 42 staff increase.
Okay, we'll get one. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
The first unit that I would like to discuss with the committee is the Institutions Division. And when an inmate first arrives at the Institutions Division, they are received at the Department of Corrections Intake Center, which is located at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. At that center, they go through an intensive 22-day intake evaluation period for assessment and initial institutional assignment. This assessment includes security classification, which also includes a list of enemies, security threat group, participation or affiliation, a medical screening that includes a complete medical history, a thorough physical examination and a dental examination, a mental health assessment to identify any mental health issues, which would include suicide risk and any developmentally disabled type problems. In addition, we do a substance abuse screen, educational assessment, as well as a cognitive assessment. Once all of these assessments are completed, the intake counselor then takes that information interviews the inmate and develops for the inmate an individualized corrections case plan that's called the corrections plan. This plan provides a framework for productive use of their incarceration time in that it identifies areas that place inmates at risk for returning to prison once they're released. We then target these risks and needs by making appropriate program assignments. The corrections plan systematically moves inmates towards acquiring positive and productive personal and pro-social skills. This contributes to a successful transition back to the community while reducing, hopefully, the risk of future criminal behavior. This strategy, it is our hope, will ultimately make Oregon safer for its citizens. This ends page 5. Would you turn? Please turn to page 6.
Before we go to 6, HIV, AIDS screening, does that take place as a part of that 22-day intake evaluation and the medical?
Chair Gorley, that would be, in fact, part of the health screening that we do at intake. And I will have some information more about the AIDS situation, how it impacts the department later on in the presentation.
Thank you.
What's the minimum time a person could be sentenced for? 6 months, 9 months, a year?
Chair Gorley and Representative Wisnat, an inmate has to have a sentence that is longer than 1 year to be able to come to the Department of Corrections.
Otherwise it goes to county.
What you have before you on page 6 is a listing of all of the institutions that we have currently in the Department of Corrections, the location of those institutions, as well as the custody level. What I'd also like to point out to you is that this listing, and some of you I think have experienced this firsthand, really depicts a evolution in prison design philosophy that dates back from present time in 1866 when the Oregon State Penitentiary was first founded. This has, and this evolution in designs have major impacts and ramifications for the way that we have to staff our prisons. Clearly, some prison designs are more efficient in terms of how you can staff them, especially when you factor in things like the technology that's available, things like the programs that are available, services, and the numbers and custody grades of the inmates involved. What you'll also see on this chart is on the very far right column is the expanded capacity of each of these institutions. And I point that out to let you know that this is not the design capacity, but in most cases is a number that is greater than the institution was originally designed to house. And I'll get more into that specifically a little bit later. This ends page 6. If you please turn to page 7. What you have on page 7 is a listing of all the different operations that the operations division is responsible to manage in terms of.
Representative Wisnat.
Okay, so let's go back and let's look at the bed capacity now. So now our projection is down. How many beds is it down now with the new forecast? And how do we look here as far as, you know, the expanded bed capability? I think we need to look at that.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisnat, for the record, Max Williams, DOC Director. Give and take on any given day, we're generally at capacity in our institutions as they're currently identified, and that's why we have some number of county rental beds that we're currently operating at. The reduction that was done in the forecast was off of the October forecast, and as Mr. Wilson pointed out, all it did was essentially drop by a couple of months the rate of growth that we were anticipating under the previous forecast. So it really doesn't change in the sense of creating additional vacancies at the institutions that you see listed here. What it does is it slows by just a couple of months our need to have additional rental beds come online as we move forward in the forecast. So on any given day, we try to operate the institutions with about a 3% vacancy rate standard to allow for both spikes in intake, which we don't necessarily have the ability to control, and also to allow enough space within the system to allow movements. As you heard Mr. Zerniak mention, we at times move individuals from institutions based on a variety of factors, both with respect to program need and if there is, for example, individuals who have gang-related activity that's creating a potential disturbance problem, or if someone, in fact, has had a health issue that needs to be in an institution with the appropriate health care facility, we would shift that person to need some available space in the system to allow for those kinds of movements to occur. When you get much beyond the 3%, every movement requires another movement. You're moving one, you're really moving two because you're having to bounce somebody out to another bed someplace else. But these capacities essentially reflect these institutions, at most of which are at a capacity beyond their original design, with about the 1,000 or so inmates that we currently have put into institutions beyond their original design capacity.
Chair Grohle, members of the committee, as I referenced earlier, the operations division also provides a stable institution environment that supports other programs and services that occur within the institutions. And this includes movement of inmates going to and from work programs, access and supervision to service providers, arrangement for delivery of materials to our prisons, and control of tools, materials, etc. This ends page 7. If you would please turn to page 8, I'll continue. On page 8, which you'll see reflected, are additional services that the operations division is involved in, and that includes food services, supervising inmates in Oregon Correctional Enterprises work, education programs, and et cetera. What we have found is that good security, while providing an environment for these programs to be successful and conducive toward risk mitigation in terms of returning back to the Department of Corrections once an inmate's released, also has receives a benefit from these programs in that these programs tend to normalize prison environments. They certainly provide inmates with skills that will give them some hope to be successful once they leave the prison environment. And they also have a lot to do with just changing some of the attitudes that inmates have towards work, towards pro-social activities and pro-social behaviors. And it's in, kind of in this area where the correctional officer staff play a very significant role in that they role model pro-social behaviors, they redirect negative behaviors, and provide inmates with an idea of more appropriate alternatives to some of their ways of reacting in the past. I'd like to now talk about the inmate counseling and case management process. We basically have two categories of counselors that are involved in this process. One is the institutional counselor, and I'll mention that first. The institutional counselor's function is to monitor inmates' progress toward completion of their corrections plan, which is, again, the plan that was developed in intake. They monitor and document inmates' conduct and behavior. They facilitate the inmate visiting process, and they act as a liaison with inmate family, social service representatives, and others to assure the inmate's corrections plan assists the inmate to successfully integrate back into society. We also have a category of counselors known as release counselors who develop release plans for inmates in collaboration and partnership with the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, with parole and probation staff, and with community providers. And this also includes a development of plans for special needs surrounding release. And those can be mental health needs, they can be victims' concerns, they can be medical needs, or in the case of community-sensitive cases, working with the community to address those inmates' needs. As a significant part of the pre-release plan, inmates who are 6 months prior to release are scheduled for specific transition classes to assist them in their preparation for reintegration back into the community. And some examples of that include identifying transition needs, family reintegration, personal finance, relapse prevention, and a successful supervision or adjustment out in the community. I'd like to now talk about health services. As this committee, I'm sure, is aware, we have a constitutional mandate to provide a health service that is equal to a community standard of care. We address this responsibility using an efficient managed care delivery system that is very, very similar to what you'll find in a community health maintenance organization. And this program includes on-site care, off-site care, specialty referral care, hospitalizations, medications, medical supplies, dental treatment, and mental health treatment. I'll give you some more specifics as we go along. This ends page 8. If you have no questions, please turn to page 9.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the inmate counseling and case management, I'm very concerned in terms of amount of services inmates are getting in terms of their preparation for release. I've seen the program that Multnomah County has in for their intensively managed people that come out. Is there a better way for us to coordinate your work in this area with community corrections work? My concerns are mentally ill women or men, for that matter, that come out of the institution that don't have SSI benefits for a period of time, that there's a break in the types of services they're receiving. It would appear that Multnomah County has been able to liaison better with Social Security and has a more seamless approach. Is there any way that we can get that type of activity spread statewide?
Chair Garland, Representative Hansen, you know, one of the reasons I think for the success that we've had in Multnomah County in terms of getting Social Security benefits and some veterans benefits addressed before the inmate leaves the institutions and back into the community is that those some communities are better able to provide resources to coordinate with us in that effort. I think that the key really is just to work as best we can with those community providers to try to get those resources established before the inmate leaves the institutions. I think that during the presentation by Assistant Director Ginger Martin, who deals with the whole transition process, will probably be able to address your issues better than I can.
And if I could, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, this is obviously, we believe, a key. Our success at developing those cooperative relationships with each of our 36 county partners is a key, we think, to being successful at transitioning inmates back to the community. Obviously, those with a higher risk to reoffend, those with mental health issues, for example, we prioritize in trying to manage that. We also recognize that transition services is not just a Department of Corrections issue. We rely on a number of our sister state agencies, the Department of Human Services, Employment, Housing and Community Services, Veterans, and others to help us provide those the cadre of services necessary for someone who's releasing back out. We've added those individuals to our Transition Steering Committee, representatives at a high level from each of those agencies to work with us to overcome some of the barriers just within the state system, and we're exploring all the opportunities to develop strategies for helping overcome some of the barriers with our federal partners as well in accessing these benefits. So I'd like to tell you that it's a work in process, but it's one that we're well aware of and we've identified, and where we found successful strategies like that in Multnomah County, we are trying to transport those to other parts of the state as both resources are available at the county level to help us do that and as we develop a better relationship with our partners.
I think what we need to have more information about as it relates to all of the counties and all inmates who are going to be releasing out into these various counties, what are the specific problems you're running into in completing release plans? There is an absence of resources in communities. We can start with mental health. We can add alcohol and drug. Add, you know, sex offender treatment. There are pieces that aren't there anymore or just haven't been there at all. So as you're putting together these plans, what does that look like? What are you running into? And how does the absence of resources inhibit
Sure.
the ability to release.
And as Mr. Zerniak said, Madam Chair, Ginger Martin, who is the Assistant Director of Transitional Services, I think is going to be able to paint a pretty good picture for you of sort of where we're at and where we're headed. I can tell you that one of the challenges that we have is, as I described the various players with the, that you have to have access to resources, just simply on the mental health side alone, as the Madam Chair knows, there is such a fragmentation in the systems delivery of mental health services throughout the state. It's not the same in county by county, and in many cases, it's not even the same necessarily in the county itself, depending on what your issue might be. It's understanding and trying to overcome some of the situation, both by a lack of resource and by the fragmentation of the system, that we're really trying to work on. I think that there's a lot of room that can be made to make it better, even without more money, simply by developing communication methodologies and the like. I think, obviously, the lack of money, if you have somebody who needs drug and alcohol treatment or who needs mental health treatment and they're on a waiting list when they release, because the resource simply doesn't exist in the county to provide those kinds of treatment, or there's not a place for them to go, there's not a housing arrangement for them to go to, those things have an immediate impact on the likelihood of that individual recidivating within the first 90 to 180 days of release.
And that's the picture that I ask you to keep painting for us, so that we really understand that piece, because you've done a great job, and I've heard you do this publicly at a town hall in my district, reminding all of us that 95% of the people that we lock up are going to come back out to the community.
That's right.
So please keep that picture so that we really understand what you're up against.
And Ms. Martin will present part of her budget discussion next week, and I'm sure we'll be happy to sort of walk you through some of those issues that she presents as well.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, mentioned to Ms. Martin that to continue this process. Two areas that I can think of, three areas that she might want to also give us some information on. Is there specific things that we as the legislature could do as we're looking at some of our other state budgets like DHS, maybe in particular, in terms of specific things that the state of Oregon could be doing that could help help prisoners in transition. Secondly, and I believe we've got something that requires that prisoners be returned to the community that in which they committed the crime or were sentenced.
Well, that's correct.
If a prisoner needed specific services, i.e. mental health, and they weren't available in that community, do we have the latitude to release them in a place where those services are
available? Chair Garland, Representative Hanson, that's a good question, and we do, in fact, try to do that when we have a case where an inmate has a particular need that cannot possibly be met, and it's a significant need. We do try to work with other counties to agree to take that inmate, and there is a process in place that we have to go through in conjunction with the parole board to get that done, and we do that in quite a few cases.
And that's working well?
Chair Gorley and Representative Hanson, I think it's working fairly well, but I think we can certainly make some improvements with that. One of the problems you end up with sometimes is the county that was not the county of commitment may not want the inmate in their county, even though they may have that service available. And sometimes that results in making a decision basically on the parole board level whether or not that's going to be overruled. Chair Gorley and the committee, one of the significant factors that contributes to the cost of health care for our inmates is that the typical inmate has, prior to coming to us, had a lifestyle that aggravates health-related problems. 70% of our inmates have come to us with substance abuse problems. A vast majority of our inmates come to us with lifestyles that have been characterized by very poor diets. Poor diets obviously are linked to a number of health-related issues, and in addition, poor diets are directly linked to a number of mental health-type problems that some inmates come to us with. In addition, the criminal lifestyle of many of our inmates is characterized by obviously non-pro-social type behaviors, which leads to certain stresses and certain kind of, you know, just a lack of organization that impacts health, impacts mental health in a negative way. And most of our inmates have been not used to receiving regular medical or dental care, and therefore come to us with a number of problems. All of these factors combine to cause our inmate population to age faster than the general population, and they bring with that aging more serious health care issues that we have to address. And as I mentioned earlier, the Department of Corrections cannot exclude inmates with major medical problems that come to us. Whatever their major issues are, we have to address those. That's been upheld in the courts. It certainly is a constitutional mandate, and it's obviously the right thing to do. I'd like to point out that delivering health care services in prison settings also requires a very close working relationship with security staff, and that's for obvious reasons. We have to control syringes. These are items that inmates would like to get a hold of in many cases. Scalpels, which can be used as weapons, sharps, scissors, etc. And we also have to be very careful on how we control medications in our institutions. Although most of our health care needs are addressed within our institutional settings, because we do not have a hospital, a corrections hospital in the Department of Corrections, severe or acute conditions that require hospital-level care and subspecialist care must be handled in the community. And there's obviously inherent risks anytime you take an inmate outside of a secure perimeter setting and then have to transfer them into the community. It's also very costly. Each time we make one of those hospital-type trips or a specialist trip out in the community, we have to provide two correctional officers to escort the inmate if they're above the level of minimum custody. But most of our services do, in fact, happen within the institution, and we have in the Department of Corrections 76 infirmary beds that are located in 5 institutions. I'd like to just review with you briefly our hospice program that we manage. Because we have very limited authority to release inmates early for medical reasons, we have developed a prison hospice program. This program involves the use of inmate peers who are trained as companions for terminally ill inmates. This is a nationally acclaimed program. Several states have come to Oregon, have toured our program, and have taken our program back to their states and used it as a model to develop their own. Currently, we have 3 hospice programs in the Oregon Department of Corrections. One is at the Oregon State Penitentiary, one's at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and one's at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Hermiston. This is a program that benefits both the caregiver and the inmates that need care and do not cost the state anything. As I mentioned earlier, vast majority of our health care encounters occur on site. But I'm going to give you some context on what that means. Medical service last year handled on an annual basis over 320,000 on-site medical encounters. This translates into 8,400 on-site infirmary patient days, 4,000 off-site specialty encounters, and 430 off-site days in an outside hospital. This ends page 9. If you have no questions, please turn to page 10. An example of seeking to save dollars and resources and also to provide for better security, we have developed a on-site dialysis program at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution Infirmary. Currently, we have 8 inmates who are receiving dialysis. And if you know anything about dialysis, it's usually a 2 or 3 day a week effort that sometimes goes 6, 7, 8 hours to complete the process. In the past, for each one of these inmates, we had to take 2 officers, take them into the community, and be with them through that entire dialysis program. So we'd have 2 officers tied up with 1 inmate to provide this service. We've been able to reduce that demand and that expense, associated expense, by having our own dialysis unit on site. It's also interesting to note that one of the inmates who requires dialysis is a death row inmate who is housed at the Two Rivers Correctional Institution. I'd like to now talk about dental services. Our dental services include preventive care for long-term inmates. Over 90% of the inmates that enter the Department of Corrections demonstrate significant tooth decay. 70% will request dental care, and inmates on average at intake have 4 cavities and 4 extractions that are required. To give you again some context as to the scope of what we're dealing with in terms of dental care, nearly 2,000 patients per month are scheduled that result in over 1,300 extractions monthly, over 1,500 dental procedures monthly, and these are mostly extractions of infected teeth and large fillings for painful cavities. Except for complicated oral surgery, all of these services are provided on-site at Department of Corrections facilities. I'd like to now talk about pharmacy services. The Department of Corrections operates a centralized pharmacy and distribution system. This affords us maximum purchasing power and cost-effective delivery of care. We have currently 2 pharmacies. One is located in eastern Oregon, adjacent to the, or actually on the property of the Snake River Correctional Institution by Ontario. The second one is located here in Salem. The pharmacies are co-located with 2 medical supply warehouses, and the primary benefits of this centralization is that we achieve efficiencies through utilization review, bulk purchases, therapeutic substitution, use of a formulary, and use of treatment protocols. Our pharmacy, to give you some context on what we do, how much service we provide with our pharmacies, in terms of necessary medications, we currently fill over 29,000 prescriptions a month, and that translates down to 1,400 a day, or over 340,000 prescriptions per year. Medication for the Department of Corrections last year cost us $6 million. Slightly over half of these medications go to mental health type inmates. I would like to inform the committee that inmates are able to purchase over-the-counter medications from our inmate canteens, and these include aspirins, Excedrin, Advil, Tylenol, Claritin, athlete's foot cream, antacids, hydrocortisone cream, and Neosporin. And also, I think a question came up earlier about the inflation rate for medical care. I can tell you that in the area of medications, the inflation rate currently is about 19% per year. This ends page...
2 questions on the pharmacy services. What is meant by therapeutic substitution?
Chair Grelly, what this means is that we have a number of medications that have proven to be both evidence-based effective and also cost-effective. Our providers are allowed to choose between some of those unless there's a very specific need for a particular medication. We usually try to go with the most cost-effective medication. Again, but also that's one by evidence is proven to be effective.
And does that also relate to medications for treating mental health conditions, or are we just talking...
Chair Gordon, that is correct.
And there is a formulary.
Chair Gordon, that's correct. We're also developing what's known as an algorithm, which basically prescribes those kind of medications that have, again, proven by evidence to be effective, but also to be cost-effective. And we encourage our physicians to prescribe those medications that are both cost-effective and effective in terms of effect. If they don't work, then we'll go to a higher cost medication and so on up. But we won't start with the highest cost medication.
I understand that there's a Senate bill, 702-704, with an amendment. Is this ringing a bell?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we know a little bit about that bill. I'm not sure I'm the best one to answer questions on it for you, but I know a little bit about it.
If I could get the department's comments on, especially if you've provided testimony on the bill or someone from the department has provided testimony, I'd like to see that. I understand it has something to do with not substituting mental health medications. if a doctor has indicated that there should not be a substitution.
And we did submit some testimony. We'll be pleased to provide, along with the State Mental Hospital and others, we'll provide you a copy of the testimony that we submit, Madam Chair. My understanding, and what little I understand about it, is I had some recollection that there was some concern that there was an immediate denial of access to the medication when someone came into our facility. And it's our policy traditionally to carry on whatever prescription someone arrives to us with. That prescription is continued at least during the initial period of evaluation that the individual is evaluated. Once they've been evaluated by our medical staff and our mental health staff, if it's deemed that there needs to be a change in their medication based on information that was obtained in those evaluations, at that point they might be changed. But they are carried through at least for the first period of time until we've completed our evaluation with the medication that they were prescribed upon entry into our facility. But we'll be pleased to provide you a copy of the testimony with respect to that bill and answer any questions that you've got about the way we use our approach. Doctors certainly have, and mental health professionals certainly have, the ability to move people to the appropriate level of prescription within the system. As you can imagine, with our costs associated with the prescriptions and it being such a large portion of our medical budget, we're careful to try to use evidence-based practices to have providers making the very best decisions they can about the appropriate medication that will have the most cost-effective result and at the same time underscore the appropriate level of treatment for the individual. It's not cost-effective for us to have individuals on the wrong medication that aren't actually benefiting from the value of the medication, because a person who has a mental health situation in our system who's inappropriately medicated ends up becoming traditionally a behavioral problem, results in them ending up in a more expensive bed with a lot more services and resources available. And that's a model that we recognize occurs in the community. It occurs inside our institutions as well, so there's a strong effort made to ensure that the person is getting the right level and the appropriate kind of medication, because the more stable that inmate with a mental health problem is in our system, the more easier they are to manage and the less expensive they are to manage as an inmate from a cost perspective.
Okay. Would Representative Hansen, and I'm going to ask Sue Acuff, if you would come up and just exchange seats with Ms. Gilbert. I have a feeling we're going to want to draw on your expertise here shortly. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm co-sponsor with Senator Carter about visa legislation. And I believe there are some discussions that have been going on between the department and Senator Carter that may be easing some of her concerns, but you might check with her in terms of what's happening.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Gardley and Representative Hansen, that's correct. And also, just wanted to point out that algorithms are widely accepted in the medical community. In fact, several large groups, such as the American Psychiatric Association, does in fact have a prescribed recommended algorithm. And we're just developing ours right now. On page 11, I'd like to...
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The pharmacy operations budget was $20 million. Did I understand you to say that $6 million is the prescription cost of the is that $20
million? Chair Gorley, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
In Representative Hanna, I believe that's an annual cost. So if you biannualize that, it's closer to
It's 12 of the 20.
It's 12 of the 20.
Thank you.
We buy our prescriptions through a statewide consortium, actually, a number of states that so we get them at a pretty good price as compared, just given the bulk volume that we purchase them on. We can share some of that detail with you if you're interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure I knew what piece of that it was.
Chair Gorley and committee, on page 11, I'm going to start out by talking about mental health services. Our official title for that is Counseling and Treatment Services, and obviously this group provides services to inmates who are suffering from mental illness. To give you an extent of the number of inmates that we have currently in our system that require mental health services, as of March 2005, the mental health caseload was about 2,900 inmates, or 23% of our inmate population. 14% of all inmates are severely mentally ill and need a continuum of care to function in a prison setting. The other 9% require lower levels of services, but some services nevertheless. Mental health case managers currently have caseloads that range from 120 to 170 inmates, and this is compared to a community standard of between 50 and 80. Also, our nurse practitioner caseloads are between 400 and 650, again, compared with the community standard of between 250 and 300. I'd like to point out that on your narrative, there is a typo, and that is at the very end of the mental health program section. That number there at the second to the last sentence should be 250, not 25. Inmates with severe and persistent mental illness are very vulnerable to personal deterioration. These inmates also tend to engage in self-harm in larger numbers and percentages than the typical inmate would. They are more vulnerable to exploitation by other inmates, and if not treated, some of these inmates can be very assaultive, not only to other inmates, but also to our staff. Therefore, these programs are critical to operating safe, secure, and orderly prisons because they reduce the frequency and severity of psychiatric symptoms, and they also tend to reduce institutional disciplinary problems.
What kind of representative was that?
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. If we look at our priority list of mental health, the $18 million, is that going to reduce this? Does that maintain the same workload? Does that reduce this workload? And best I can determine, that was not reduced by the co-chair. At 18 point almost two. Number 13. Corrections, treatment, mental health.
If I could, Mr. Zerniak, just jump in. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett is near. That's simply taking sort of our budget and putting it on a priority list. So it neither increases nor decreases. It is the amount of money essentially tied directly to our delivery of mental health services as identified in the governor's recommended budget.
Representative Hansen.
Would that include the $6 million for mental health drugs?
No, that's from the budget. Chair Gorley, Representative Hansen, that would be in the pharmacy.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, if you were to look at item number 14 directly underneath that, the $20,000,957, which is that biennial pharmacy cost, would include the actual medication purchase costs associated with that.
What kind of training do your correction officers receive around understanding mental illness, mental health issues? Could you talk about that, please?
Chair Gorley, sure. I'd be happy to, and members of the committee. Currently, we are offering 4 hours of in-service training for each employee this coming training cycle, which we train every year. In addition to that, those officers and those staff that work in special housing, I'm going to be talking about special housing in a few minutes, those particular staff that work there receive additional training, and it depends on the specific program that you're looking at, but they can receive up to another 40 hours of training dealing with those type of inmates. This kind of leads into my next area, and that is for those inmates whose mental health problems are so severe that they can't function in a open population, open prison population setting. We have what we call our special management units, and these units are currently located at three institutions, and at this date consist of 72 special management unit beds. These beds are used for both crisis intervention and for the delivery of long-term services. The length of stay in these programs really depends on the individual level of need. Some severely mentally ill inmates, in fact, may be assigned to a special management unit for the majority of their time while incarcerated with us. We estimate that currently, the number of special management unit beds in our system is about really half the number that we need. This shortage was recognized by both the governor's mental health task force and the managing mentally ill in prison task force that was commissioned by Director Williams. Plans are currently being developed to increase the number of special management unit beds within our existing bed space capacity, and we're looking at several options right now to do that. And for the long term, the Department of Corrections is evaluating the need for more special management unit beds in future prisons. The Department of Corrections is also working closely with the Oregon State Hospital, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and others such as the Oregon Youth Authority and the Mental Health Division to develop a comprehensive long-term mental health plan that may include a special forensics unit. 3%, as Director Williams I think mentioned earlier, 3% of our inmate populations have been assessed to be developmentally disabled. These inmates have severe intellectual impairment and are offered services as developmentally disabled persons. These inmates are identified at intake, monitored throughout their incarceration, and this is to protect them from harm from other inmates and to help them to be able to function in our prison environments. Currently, we have a program that's referred to... I'm sorry.
Excuse me. I want you to complete your thought. I don't want to cut you off from completing your thought.
Okay, Chair Grohl. And all my thought was is that we do have currently 50 available slots for dealing with these for male inmates that have developmentally disabled issues at the Oregon State Correctional Institution for Men, and we also have 6 of these slots available at.
In your case, you may need to have it now.
I appreciate your indulgence.
Yes. I was so excited coming over, I forgot to shut my pager off. For women. Now, that really is quite a bit less than I think that we really need within our system. We currently have, I think, upwards of 50 inmates that probably could receive these services on a greater basis than we're able to currently provide. In addition, the Department of Corrections has a step-down program for those... Oh, I'm sorry.
Before you go forward, I want to go back to my question about training. What you gave me in response to the question was the number of hours of in-service, 4 hours of in-service upcoming, and then 40 hours of in-service altogether, I believe is how you...
Chair Grohl, yes, we do have a 40-hour in-service program for all of our staff each year. What I was referring to, the 40 hours, would be different training opportunities that we have for staff that work in special management unit, that work in our disciplinary segregation units, and also that work with inmates in our intensive management units.
What I am looking for to flesh out this information is, what is the content of the training? Not just the hours, but what's the content? What have been your learnings about the content of the training? Do you have the resources that you need in the staff, the trained staff, to manage this population that does have these special needs? If you could flesh that out for us either today or come back with a more detailed response.
Sure, Gordon, and I appreciate the question. We do, in fact, have certainly curricula for each one of these training opportunities. I don't have all the particulars around that, but I can tell you that they include things such as indicators of mental illness so that our staff are able to recognize mentally ill type behaviors and not respond to those kind of behaviors as if they are threats to them or you know, in some cases disrespect or refusing to obey orders. So staff can kind of differentiate between mental health type behaviors, know how to respond to those, and then also, more importantly, I think, know how to access mental health trained assistance in dealing with some of those inmates and some of those behaviors.
That's very helpful.
And Madam Chair, if I could just make a comment, I think it's fair to say that by and large, as the percentage of number of mentally ill inmates has risen over the years, the department has found itself to some degree in a catch-22 and was probably not as prepared as it would have liked to have been to start to have to deal with this population. We are recognizing, I think, that the enhanced level of training necessary to address this mentally ill population is to some degree a new feature, not just being experienced by our system, but by systems around the country trying to address this issue. And we're going to continue to enhance and improve that. Again, I think it's fair to say that this is an expensive population to manage in a resource-limited environment. Would like to provide, you know, if all things being equal, would like to provide a full 40-hour training for all of our correctional officers, because at some point in their career, all of them are going to have contact with this. But from a scheduling, a staffing, and an expense standpoint, we're simply not there. So we currently budget 40 hours for total in-service training system-wide. There's always at least 80 to 160 hours of things we'd like to train on, and then we prioritize. And this year we took some stuff out to allow for a dedicated four-hour in-service curricula on mental health.
And again, what we need your help with is being as explicit as you can be around, do you have the tools and resources you need, your staff needs, to
right.
manage this special population? And frankly, from where I sit, you know, 4 hours of in-service that doesn't cut it, you know. So, again, you need to...
And we would tell you that it's a start, Madam Chair, but we know that it's not an end.
All right.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. I would suggest that we maybe bring this up with Director Minnis when we talk about the
yes.
public safety standards and training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my experience is you know, we want to give as much training as we could to him, and you're just providing what we call on the job training or on site training. But we can maybe expand it at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Senator
Devlin? Thank you. Senator Gorley's question, I believe, may be broadly looked at in terms of correctional personnel and the amount of training that they receive in this area, which is probably relatively modest. Do you make any special effort for those staff, not the therapists that you might have or that, but for those correctional staff, the working units like SMU, in terms of their training and in terms of how much exposure they get to?
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin, right. And that's exactly what I was referring to in terms of those staff that work in special management units, that work in our intensive management units, and I'll tell you more about that a little bit later, and those staff that are assigned to work in our segregation units do receive specialized mental health training to help them to cope with some of the kinds of behaviors that they have to deal with, and also to really teach them what signs to look out for that you probably wouldn't have to look out for when you're supervising inmates that don't have severe mental health problems, and then how to get assistance from trained staff for particularly severe episodes that occur within those housing units.
Madam Chair, if I might follow up too.
Certainly.
In terms of the larger custody staff, correctional staff, I don't think we maybe need to reiterate this, but you've brought up several times your difficulty as you expand facilities in finding qualified staff within a reasonable period of time. I mean, each time you open up one of these facilities, particularly those that are distant from any workforce base, you've had difficulties getting qualified staff. Would that be a fair statement? I'm not saying you haven't succeeded, but it's been a difficult task.
Chair Gorley and Senator Devlin, yeah, the reality is that corrections is a very, very demanding, very, in some cases very stressful, very dangerous type of profession, and it is difficult in some parts of the state to attract individuals who would be qualified to work in those type of settings. We have less problem here in the Valley where we have a larger workforce to draw from, but you are correct, in Eastern Oregon that is more of a problem for us.
And you might, Madam Chair, final follow-up, just for the committee's information, could you provide a salary range for your custody staff? so that they understand what their current salary ranges are.
Chair Gordley and Senator Devon, we'll get that information for you.
Okay.
Representative Hansen, and then I have another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I picked up your two percentages correctly, 14% of your inmates have serious mental health issues, and 3% are developmentally disabled. Based on 12,000 population, that would be almost 2,700 people with mental issues and 360 developmentally disabled. Have we considered dedicating facilities for those populations?
Sure.
In terms of if we had a dedicated mental illness facility, if you could concentrate more of the training in the people that are working in that particular facility and concentrate the programs and the help in those facilities, if there would be better utilization of both our facilities as well as the workforce to help to run them, especially when we're talking about expanding and building and creating new facilities.
Chair Gordley and Representative Hansen, one of the models that we're looking at in terms of expanding our availability of mental health programs and services to inmates does in fact start to move in the direction that you're speaking of, and that would be to have an institution that would largely specialize in mental health type inmates. I think one of the drawbacks of that would be that we would have to possibly duplicate almost every service that we have available at other institutions at that one location. That may be difficult to do, but I think we can move in that direction where it makes sense to do that. We're certainly taking a look at that.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, as well, one of the challenges we face is, again, with individuals with this mental illness who are inside our system, we've sort of as a society kind of swung between the idea of large institutionalization of individuals with mental health to mainstreaming those individuals more in a community-based population, and I think that's been a similar trend within the department. As Mr. Zerniak commented, some of these individuals, when appropriately counseled and have the right medication or are involved in the right kind of programs, can effectively participate in other prison opportunities within the system, whether it be employment or other kinds of opportunities. So we are sensitive, obviously, to the advocates, to their families, and to these individuals as well, who will ultimately release back out into a much less structured, much less institutionalized environment to ensure that we do the best thing for them, to prepare them for their ultimate release back into the community. And that means trying to also mainstream them within our system as much as possible to where they can be employed within a corrections environment in a prison-based job and doing those kinds of activities that would more simulate what they're going to experience when they release. So it's balancing the ability to target a bunch of resources in one place with a large mental health population against also the need to ensure that we're providing them the very best kinds of environment that is going to make their transition back to the community the most effective, and not penalizing them to some degree because of their mental health issue by denying them access to other services that other inmates would get in every way from, you know, what little recreation opportunity to potential employment opportunities within the system. So you can understand the balance that we feel like we need to strike as we move down this path to ensure that we're treating those with the most severe need in the best possible way, but also providing as much opportunity for those who can manage effectively with the right kind of treatment and with the right kind of medication on their own in their own environment and mainstream them back in the least restrictive means possible into the general population of the prison system.
While we are still in this, kind of training realm, Mr. Zerniak and Director Williams, could you both comment on what can you tell us about the cultural competence of people in your organization as it relates to their ability to manage all these different populations, whether it's mental health, given that said, the disproportionate number of people of color. You have challenges around different gang elements. Talk to us about the cultural competence of the people who work in these institutions.
I can certainly, Madam Chair and members of the committee, provide my couple of cents worth, and then Mr. Zerniak has probably had more hands-on experience, obviously, than I have. I believe the department has demonstrated a long commitment to working with the populations, the various cultural populations that we have within the institution, whether it be a strong, active Native American population and the religious services issues that are required for us to provide there, or in our efforts at appropriate management of our gang-related groups and organizations within the system. We have a number of people who I think are very effective at working with these folks. There is a certain amount of obvious self-selection when people are incarcerated. They will gravitate towards certain groups. Not all, but many will. Managing those populations from a safety and security standpoint requires that we have people who understand what's going on among these groups, whether they be white supremacist gang-affiliated groups in our institution, or whether they are other groups who have different philosophies. And I think we have a tremendous depth of knowledge in our institutions of people who have spent and are spending their professional career trying to understand these folks, trying to communicate with them, and then trying to use whatever means we have, both in our program delivery and in our management practices, to demonstrate pro-social behaviors. We don't condone or tolerate gang-related activity within the institution. We spend a fair amount of effort trying to weed out, undermine, and split up the individuals who are leading those organizations in a way that are going to be harmful not only to the individuals and the staff of the organization, but to our overall mission of trying to change people's behavior. And we can't do that effectively if we don't have people who understand where those people are coming from and have an ability to communicate with them. We've got certainly more to learn, and certainly more we could be doing, I think, in this respect. But in the year and 4 months that I've been at the organization, I've been very impressed at the level of commitment that the people who work with these various populations have to understanding and helping the department achieve its mission.
Can I add to that, Chair Gourley?
I appreciate hearing that there is a commitment, no doubt, but surely there must be challenges as well, and we are a committee that want to hear about the challenges that you may be facing in this area.
Yeah. Chair Gourley, in addition to just add on to what Director Williams' information he supplied to you, we do have what we call diversity managers at a number of our institutions, who deal with issues of diversity. They also address complaints from various cultural groups regarding any perceived discrimination. We take that very seriously. We respond to that very definitely. In addition, we have at a number of our institutions multicultural clubs. We have the Uhuru at the Oregon State Penitentiary. We have Hispanic groups. We have Native American groups at our prisons, and we allow these groups to have multicultural events throughout the year at a number of institutions, again to try to instill a sense of diversity and to help inmates to appreciate other inmates' cultures and their diverse backgrounds. And as Director Williams said, one of the natures of prison gangs, security threat groups, is that they tend to be formed along cultural lines. We have a zero tolerance for any activity that would be within that purview of gangs. When we take very, very definite action against the inmates who engage in extortion, who engage in trying to pressure other groups out of their possessions or to do favors for them and that kind of thing.
That's very helpful information. Thank you.
Okay, where I left off was to talk about those inmates who while not really being so severely impaired that they need to be in a full-time special management unit, do have a number of mental health issues that really preclude from them being able to successfully deal in a open prison environment without some sort of mental health support. These inmates are involved in what we call our step-down programs, and actually a step-down program can be an inmate that wasn't a special management unit, is transitioning back to an open population, but just isn't quite ready to get there, but doesn't need to be in special management unit and receive the level of services that's available there. Or they can be inmates in an open population that need additional supports but don't need a full-blown special management involvement. Currently, we have what we call the Challenge of Prison Experience Program, abbreviated as COPE. It's a 64-bed program at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. Involves day treatment and helps those inmates who are struggling to function in an open population. We also have about 50%, 50-plus percent of our inmates who have mental health problems also have substance abuse problems. These inmates with co-occurring disorders are programmed through a transition program. One is called Bridgepoint. And Bridgepoint is a program that's located at the Columbia River Correctional Institution, which is a 50-bed unit for males. And we have a program called In Focus, which is a transition program for women, which is located at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, and that consists of 54 beds. This concludes page 12. If you would please turn to page 13. The next unit I'd like to discuss with the committee is our Capacity and Resource Unit. And this is a unit that is responsible for balancing the overall inmate population between our institutions. They're the group that makes sure that we have the right classification in the right institution, that we don't have too many of one particular security threat group at one institution where they can dominate. And as Director Williams mentioned earlier, it's not uncommon for our system to have a capacity less than 2% vacancy. That becomes very difficult to move inmates around to make sure that we don't have enemies located at the same institution where one can prey on the other and cause other types of problems. Through the use of classification and assessment tools, the Department of Corrections tries to maximize treatment opportunities and mitigate security concerns resulting in safe, secure, and orderly operations. We also provide liaison services to the Oregon Youth Authority for Department of Corrections youth who are housed at the Oregon Youth Authority. Currently, we have 283 males who are with the Oregon Youth Authority and 26 females for a total of 306 inmates. I'd like to also just advise the committee, kind of brief you, that if an individual is 15 years old but he's committed as an adult, they must be housed with the Oregon Youth Authority. Convicted felons aged 16 through 25 who are sentenced as an adult may be housed at Oregon Youth Authority facilities. If a youth is 19 years old or older at the time of commitment, they will not go to the Oregon Youth Authority. Of those housed in the Oregon Youth Authority, any youth age 16 or over may be transferred back to the Department of Corrections, and that's usually because of behavioral type problems that those youth were having. Currently, in our population, we have 213 individuals who were transferred to us from the Oregon Youth Authority. Of the 309 total currently housed in the Oregon Youth Authority, 54 of these inmates have sentences that will exceed their time in the Oregon Youth Authority, and they will, in fact, come to the Department of Corrections. The Capacity and Resource Unit also has a section known as the Population Management Section, and what this group does is to coordinate the department-wide use of special purpose beds associated with behavioral management of inmates and to hold inmates accountable. I mentioned earlier the Intensive Management Unit. This is a program unit for inmates who are severely disruptive, for inmates who are extremely assaultive, and I know that members of this committee toured that unit last week. And the just give you some context, the intensive management unit is known in other states as Supermax. That's probably our closest thing to a Supermax unit here in the state of Oregon. Unlike other states, or at least some other states, we do make that a program unit and try to help the inmates to transition back into the community, back into the open population as soon as we possibly can. We also manage an administrative segregation unit for those inmates who have enemies or are vulnerable to being preyed upon by other inmates and need protection. And we have a disciplinary segregation process which deals with those inmates who are violating the rules, need some time out from the open population, and it's kind of similar to having a jail without inside of a prison, where we have long-term disciplinary confinement, short-term disciplinary confinement, as opposed to what typically is a more long-term arrangement in the intensive management unit. Currently, we have a total of 304 intensive management beds in the system. To give you some context, in most states, or kind of just a general rule in our profession, most states would tell you that they have to have at least 5% of their beds as supermax or intensive management unit type beds. Oregon currently has less than 3% devoted for that purpose. This is the end of page 13. Please turn to page 14. In the area of special housing units for female offenders, we currently have a total of 40 beds that are available for that purpose. And we have, because these numbers are low, we have made these basically kind of multi-purpose beds where in those 40 beds we could have either intensive management unit inmates, disciplinary segregation unit inmates, or administrative segregation inmates. The average length of stay in the intensive management unit is less than 8 months, and approximately 80% of those inmates who transition out of a intensive management unit bed have no need to return, so we feel that we have a fairly good success rate. That the problem is that those 20% that come back to intensive management tend to come back time and time again, and these individuals have some very, very severe and very difficult to work with problems. I'd like to talk a little bit about the administration.
Mr. Zerniak?
Yes.
These are not inmates who would have mental health issues?
Chair Gorley, some of these inmates do, in fact, have some mental health inmates, and they do, in fact, receive services from the mental health unit. Currently, we have...
If I could, to follow your train of thought, Madam Chair, these beds are different than the special management unit beds where the individual is having... Where their activity was not either dangerous or wasn't a behavioral-related issue. And so a decision is made as to whether or not a person's activity would warrant them going to a special management unit for mental health treatment, or whether it was more behavioral-directed and requires that they either go to DSU or to the intensive management unit. We are cognizant of the fact that because, as you can imagine, it is sometimes difficult based on staff's ability to understand whether or not someone is acting as a result of a mental health issue or simply a behavioral problem, where they ought to end up. And we work closely with our counseling and treatment services people to have those individuals appropriately evaluated, and if necessary, changes are made and their assignment is changed. But there is no question that some portion of the population who are in the intensive management unit are people who do have mental health issues, but they can be and often are effectively treated and managed down there. But it does present some challenges for us, there's no question. And if you wanted me to identify one of those challenges we've got, that is one of the ones that I would say. We have a limited number of special management unit beds, mental health beds, 74 or so statewide. When those beds are full and someone is either being a danger to themselves or others within the institution or staff, they often, based on their behavior, will end up in our intensive management unit, still receiving mental health services, but may in some cases would be better placed if there was available bed space in a more mental health treatment oriented kind of an environment. And that is a constant balance we are trying to make, and it's one of the challenges we have given the resources currently in the system.
Okay, very good. You did follow my train of thought. And we have about 6 minutes remaining.
Mr.
Zerniak. Chair Gurley, thank you. And also, just to briefly add on to what Director Williams said, one of the goals that we have with trying to expand the number of special management unit beds that we them currently have is to in fact be able to take some of those inmates out of the intensive management unit who have the more severe mental health problems and deliver the service to them elsewhere, which is probably more conducive to their needs. The Department of Corrections has a total of 726 disciplinary segregation beds. Nationally, the general accepted number of disciplinary segregation beds is felt to be about 10% of the population. So in the case of the Oregon Department of Corrections, that would translate out to be very close to 1,300 beds as opposed to the 726 that we have. So what that means to us is oftentimes a particular institution may have their disciplinary confinement unit absolutely full, and when they have a disciplinary problem, we're basically faced with two alternatives. One is to either kick out somebody early so that we can accommodate another inmate that may need that bed more severely, or if we have housing available somewhere else in the system, we may decide to have a trip take these inmates to another institution. And it, as we become more and more crowded, this becomes more of a challenge for us to manage.
Could you review those numbers again? The national standard is...
Chair Gordon, and I'd like to hasten to add that it's really kind of an accepted standard out there. I don't know that you'll find that written down anywhere, but typically I think if you talk to people throughout the country, they'll tell you that it's generally believed that you need to have about 10% of your beds that are dedicated to disciplinary segregation purposes. So for an instance...
That's a different kind of assessment of what this is about, you know, to call it a national standard, but then to call it an accepted standard not written down any place is kind of...
Chair Gordon, that's a point well taken. And unfortunately, our profession has a number of those kind of standards that...
Let's identify those as we go along.
We'll do that. We'll do that.
Chair.
Representative Hanson.
I guess it doesn't make a lot of difference if it's not written down, that it may not be broken down any farther. Is there a difference between the amount of disciplinary beds that would be standard for a maximum security facility versus medium versus minimum?
Chair Gorley and Representative Hanson, you would think that there would be, but there are a number of times that we do have to, in fact, and I think you're correct. I probably should answer that differently. I think you're correct. The higher custody grades typically probably would need more, but probably the greatest need would be in our medium custody institutions because those inmates are not isolated as much as your maximum security inmates would be, and they have more opportunity, quite frankly, to get into behaviors that break the rules and cause us to have to resort to using disciplinary confinement.
Okay. If you could run through the numbers again. The 1,300 was what?
Chair Gurley, I'm sorry.
Could you unpack those numbers again? You used the number 1,300 to describe...
Okay, yeah, Chair Gurley, what it was is that if you took 10% of our population currently and use that as a basis to provide disciplinary segregation beds for 10% of that population, it would be 1,278 disciplinary segregation beds.
And we have about 726 now spread throughout the institutions.
All right. I have an item for the good of the committee before we adjourn.
Okay. This might be a good place to stop, Mr. Zerniak, and we'll see you back next week.
Thank you, Chair Gorley, and members of the committee.
Ms. Acuff. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remember the last meeting I was at for the OYA, we talked about the Bulls case and how I was upset with what was being done or lack not being done. Since then, I've met with Mr. Jester, and Mr. Jester explained some of the people he briefed on the contract that they're proposing to release to look at this situation. I made a suggestion to him that report not be presented to OIA. They've already gone to the step of starting the contract. The governor was happy with what they're doing. I suggested that the report, however, be presented to a representative from the Senate, appointed by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, and a representative from the Attorney General's office, and not to OIA. I think if they're contracting for someone to look in OIA and report back to them, that didn't seem to have much credibility with me, and so he's willing to do that, and I will follow up as they proceed with the contract and ask him to show me that. But I thought, to me, that gave me a better feeling, if we're going to look at something, to not be reporting back to the people that are contracting and paying for the contract, but to have a more open audience.
The discussion we had in committee about that, and I don't know if you were able to follow on your television monitor, we requested that OIA, that the report go to the Senate President, the Speaker of the House, and we added that it also come directly to this committee.
Good.
Since
okay.
this was the only committee in the building that had heard the issues.
Good. Thank you, Mayor. Yeah, that's fine. When we were talking, they just said the President would appoint a representative and the Speaker, but that's it. And we didn't talk about this committee. I would suggest still our committee may want to invite someone from the Attorney General's office to hear that, but I think that would be good.
That's an excellent suggestion. Looking ahead to next week, we will have a day of public testimony, which is on the...
On Wednesday of next week.
Is that the 12th? April 12th, I believe.
I'd have to check.
Okay. And one of my concerns, and I'm going to ask Mr. Wilson to work with us on this, is that we're going to have... I anticipate we're going to have a good number of... people from the communities around Oregon who want to come and provide testimony. We're going to need a larger room. And I think that we will also need a longer period of time to hear the testimony. So I'm going to be working with leadership around extending our committee hearing for an additional hour. Just want to give you that heads up so that we can all plan for that. If there's no other business, then we are adjourned.
Thank you, Major.